Hey, how's everybody doing? Hope you're having a fantastic day. So today I wanted to do an interesting stream. If you haven't noticed, everyone out there, I do these usually every Monday, sometimes every Tuesday. The series that I'm currently in on the Filioque, I'm just going to keep doing Filioque videos every single week until I run out of things to talk about. I actually did a lot of translation work within Zhugi. If you don't know Martin Zhugi, he was a Orientalist in the early to mid 20th century. He has some very extensive, he did some very extensive work of historical research into Eastern Christianity. So he's a very important figure. Famously, he did work on Palamas. It's been critiqued, but he was kind of the guy who broke the ground on scientific work on Palamas, and he was like going through unpublished texts and doing a bunch of crazy stuff to figure out about what Palamas taught, something which just wasn't being done during his day. So he's very interesting, very erudite, very well-educated in the Eastern tradition. So he's another one of those guys, along with Franzlin and Patavius, that just produced some of the best defenses of the Filioque from the Church Fathers. But before we continue, I just wanted to remind you that I want this series, from the beginning I've been adamant about this, I want the series on the Filioque to be completely free for everyone, because I think this is something which is very helpful. A lot of people have reached out to me, thanked me, because they a lot of the points that I bring up just aren't in the sort of Anglosphere Filioque debates. So a lot of interesting stuff that people have never heard of on these debates, very systematic. So I want to keep this completely free, but this does take significant time each week, because a lot of these things are me translating Latin texts for myself and then going through the references and then going and finding these references in Mignet, or even some of these aren't even in Mignet. And then basically doing a bunch of work like that, which takes a few hours making slides. So it may seem like it's only like a 30-minute video, but it definitely takes a lot more than that to actually prepare all of the material, going through my notes and such to make sure that I am systematic and honest with my method. So I would really appreciate it if those of you who have profited from this series on the Filioque, those of you who come back and watch it each week, if you are of the means to, I would appreciate it if you guys became a patron, patreon.com/militantthomist. It doesn't cost that much each month. There's everything from $101, which is, that one's kind of a joke one, but the $101 one, because there's a $100 one as well. Because people were fighting over who would be the top one. But anyways, that's a story for a different day. Everything from that to like a $2 one, which kind of just gives you Discord access for conversations about this sort of thing. But I would appreciate it if just a few of you became patrons. That would definitely make my day for sure. Because as not a few of you know, I haven't really talked about this in public, I am planning on moving to Rome to do studies at a pontifical university over there. I'm not going to say which one. I want it to be next fall, but, you know, depends on kind of savings and cash flow because it's hard to get a job out there. So I definitely want to have that settled before I leave. So I don't really know how my output is going to be, but I hope it stays consistent. But becoming a patron definitely helps with that. Anyways, I will continue now. So what I wanted to talk to you guys about today, I know I mentioned like 5 minutes ago. I always do this. I mentioned like 5 minutes ago. I have this interesting topic for you. Then I don't tell you what the topic is. So the topic today is two 6th century Greek fathers that I wanted to bring up and show that they taught the Filioque. Because often what we get in this narrative that Shishensky has set out for people, you get this discussion of the Cappadocians kind of Athanasius as well. And then it focuses on some Western polemical. It's a very polemical book. It's not too good as a historical survey. And then it kind of jumps from the Cappadocians to like St. Cyril. And then the narrative jumps to Maximus. And then the narrative jumps to John of Damascus. Well, what's the issue with that? Well, the issue with that is there's actually a lot of theologians besides the Cappadocians, Cyril, Maximus, and John of Damascus. There's a lot of Greek theologians who are writing during these times. And what should set off some red flags, especially about Shishensky's account, is that there's a lot of jumping around going on. Because oftentimes when we look back at history, we kind of flatten the plane when we look back. So when we're thinking about the Cappadocians, Maximus, John of Damascus, and they use, this term, aetios, they must mean this, they must mean that. They use these terms, they must mean this. What we have to remember is these guys are hundreds of years apart. And with some of them, obviously, like John of Damascus is being influenced by the Cappadocians very heavily, and St. Cyril as well. And then St. Maximus is being influenced by definitely... St. Cyril for sure when it comes to his teaching on the Filioque. We kind of forget that there's these time differences and distance differences that are going on. We're not just like receiving complete works of these authors that you can kind of gaze through like we can, that are searchable and in an appropriate dialect to us, and then and so on and so forth. So we kind of, when we look back at these historical narratives, we just flatten the plane. And what's very, very much a note of somebody who flattens the plane historically is when they have this sort of hop, skipping, and a jumping around. And they don't show a sort of consistent usage between these times to show a technical term. So what's really important with these is the fathers of the 6th century is very important when it comes to this. Because the fathers of the 6th century, which most of their works are against the Nestorians, against the Monophysites, there's a lot of Christological debates in the 6th century. Most of these authors are kind of just skipped over in these narratives. They just get ignored. A lot of people just don't know about the 6th century Greek fathers at all. they're just, you know, there. They kind of just memory hole everything between Cyril and Maximus and pretend like nothing happened there. But there was a lot of stuff going on there. So what I wanted to do is I actually, from Zhugi, Leontius of Byzantium, I did an interview actually with the translator of Leontius. So if you guys are interested in that, look, I'm pretty sure I'm the only guy on YouTube who's ever done a video interview on Leontius of Byzantium. But let me just check real quick, to make sure that I am. Yep. Leontius of Byzantium. So, what I wanted to do is I wanted to go through some texts that Leontius of Byzantium in English, by the way, so you can look through his works and read his works if you wanted to. And then Anastasius of Antioch as well, who is a contemporary with Pope St. Gregory the Great. And these two are important theologians of that era. And Zhugi kind of goes over some of their teaching on the procession of the Spirit. And I wanted to present that from a perspective kind of looking back and looking forward. We can look back at some similar language and arguments which are made from the Cappadocians and St. Athanasius and St. Cyril especially. We can also look forward and see how they're influencing the later Byzantine tradition as well. So first, who, and I have no pictures of these guys. So thank you. So where do you find the Discord link as a Patreon supporter? Oh yeah, so I automated it. So you should get one. If not, just message me and I'll send it to you. absolute nonsense. Read him, sold no filioque. Real, so true. Okay, so these guys, there's no pictures of these guys anywhere. Actually, I think I found one of Athanasius of Antioch. I did find one. I forgot to put it in. No pictures of these guys anywhere, because these are actually sometimes called the minor fathers. Very unfortunate. They're called the minor fathers. We got major fathers and minor fathers. A lot of this era just gets memory hold, kind of like the 11th, the sort of pre-scholastic, post-patristic era in the West also gets memory hold like this. And then medieval Byzantine theology also kind of gets memory hold. But like, yeah, these hundreds of years of theologians kind of just didn't exist. that's how the 6th century theologians are treated. But he wrote works against the Monophysites and the Nestorians. So he also is known for, although not all agree that he should be known for this, but he is known for his development of the concept of enhypostasia, or enhypostatization. The tongue twister right there. Say that 10 times fast. So the idea that the human nature of Christ is enhypostatic, that is, it's a nature without a hypostasis, and then it receives its hypostatization. That, again, say that 10 times fast, from the hypostasis of the word. He systematically laid that out. Famously, he destroyed the Agnoetae, which were a Christological heresy that denied that, basically attributed speculative ignorance to the humanity of Christ. And then he was known for his use of Aristotelian philosophy and theology. He's actually sometimes referred to as a sort of proto-Byzantine scholastic, which is really interesting. Watch the Father Daily video that I made on Leontius. He's a very interesting figure. And then there's also this big old dispute. Is there the second Leontius of Jerusalem? That's not a really important dispute. The works that are received are received. Okay, so continuing. Oh, man, so St. Photius the Great. Oh, wow. I think you mean Photius the Terrible. Ban user. Okay, let's continue. Yeah, let's... I really don't get this. I'm gonna go on like a 30-second rant. I see this on my other Filioque videos as well. People, what they'll do is they'll kind of come on and state like some sort of like popular level arguments that everybody has heard like 10 gorillion times before, and then they'll just like spam it. Like John of Damascus said, not from the sun, just like say it 10 million times, rather than, you know, kind of responding to the counter response or whatever. It's just annoying. If you do that, you're just going to get banned. I think I've done it to like 20 Eastern Orthodox in my comments already. It's really annoying. But let's continue. So first, and this is, I think, honestly, the most interesting of all that I've seen on this topic, is Leontius of Byzantium. He defines the term image. He defines the term image. Why is this important? So the reason this is important for a good reader of the Greek fathers is that the Greek fathers very often use this term image to denote the relationship that the Son has to the Father, which is scriptural, but also they extend that to denote the relationship that the Spirit has to the Son. So since the time of John Beccos, Patriarch John Beccos in the 13th century, theologians have always pointed out this language, and Patavius brings it out in a lot of detail. But often this language that is articulated via the relationship of the son in the to the father is appropriated to the spirit of the son. And of course, even before John Bekos, there was this realization amongst Latin theologians especially of this fact. And this actually was the original context of St. Thomas's Contra Errores Graecorum, against the errors of the Greeks, which really isn't a refutation of the Greeks. It's an explanation for why the Greek fathers and the language that the Greek fathers use isn't necessarily contradictory to the Latins. Basically what happened, somebody made a compendium of quotes from the Greek fathers, most of which were forged, and said, hey, look, Greek fathers are contradicting Latin dogma, blah, 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 blah. So Thomas wrote a whole treatise showing that these quotes, which were supposedly from the Greek fathers, didn't actually necessarily contradict Latin dogma. It's very interesting. It seems that St. Thomas actually knew that these quotes weren't genuine. He never uses them again in his works. And St. Thomas is an extremely consistent quoter throughout his work. So it seems like he at least thought they were dubious, which is why he never quotes them again. But anyways, that aside, what is interesting is that the reason that the Latins were freaking out about this is because of this language. It actually seemed like there was a sort of exclusion. And I mentioned this in my debate with David Erhan when it comes to St. Athanasius. The language is so intense when it comes to the relationship of the Son to the Spirit in some of these authors. Like, the Spirit is the word of the Son. The Spirit is the image of the Son. The Spirit is the form of the Son, and so on and so forth. This language is so intense about the relationship between the Spirit and the Son that oftentimes it seems like the Father is excluded. This was known, and this was often ended up after this was explained piously by many theologians. This ended up becoming an argument for the filioque to show that these don't necessarily exclude the Father. They're rather just positing a relationship between the Spirit and the Son. But one of these is image. So this word image is used by the fathers both, as I said, to denote the relationship between the Spirit and the Son, and then the Son and the Father. And he explains what this means. Very fascinating. He says, the Son is called the image of the Father when, together with his nature, his idiom, so his property, hypostatic property, is also thought of, that is, to be from a cause, from an aetios. For the concept of an image is this. So he's going to tell us, okay, what does image mean in this regard when we're talking about the Trinity? The concept or logos, the logos of an image is this. That besides the common concept, common logos of likeness, so not only is it likeness, it also has this. It is not the prototype, but derives its origin from the exemplar. And this is its proper concept, its proper logos. So when we talk about image, image is not merely designating likeness or consubstantiality, if you may. It's not merely designating that. It also designates a sort of likeness with origin. So we talk about, let's say, me as an image of my father. I have an origination in my father, so I can be called an image of my father. Now let's turn that around. Can my father be called an image of me? No, because there's no derivation or origination there. So not only is likeness sufficient, not only is consubstantiality sufficient, which the Greeks are going to argue that this is what it's designating, but rather it needs some sort of origin from the exemplar. So very fascinating from Leontius of Byzantium. Okay, now continuing, he has another place in the same work, which can be found in Mignet's volume 86. So same work, he lists off the idiomata or the properties of the Son. There's a very interesting one that it isn't too explicit, but I think that it's a fair one to bring up. So he says, observe that the person of the Word, even before the incarnation, had a synthesis of idiomata, of properties, although of fewer. First, so there's four that he lists. First, it is not only a property of the Son to subsist or to be begotten by generation. So that's the first one, to be begotten by generation. But second, but also not to generate a consubstantial word. So not himself to be a father. That's the second. Nor for the Holy Spirit to first proceed from himself. And then fourth, nor to proceed according to the mode of the Holy Spirit. I want you to notice a little word right there in number three. Nor for the Holy Spirit to first proceed from himself. To first proceed from himself. Notice that little protos there, that little first. So what does this imply? If the Holy Spirit doesn't first proceed from the Son, there is some sort of mode, a sort of second procession from the Son. And this can easily be taken in the sense of the Cappadocian Fathers and Cyril, and then also Maximus a little bit later. This can be absolutely taken in the sense of the sort of mediated procession, or that by which we're going to see, actually, right here with this language of, and native Greek speakers, don't make fun of me for this, because this is like an extremely difficult word, but dioporthmutes. I think I pronounced that right. But it's literally a ferryman or a conveyor. So sort of a person who mediates the transportation of something. So in terms of the idiomatic relations of the Father, Son, and Spirit, so notice these are idiomatic, so intertrinitarian relations that he's listing off. The Father and the Son are distinguished by Leontius in relation to the Spirit, in that the Father as protos is the ek pruten, so that the one which proceeds or processes, or the one who possesses the act of procession, if you want to put it like that. But in terms of the idiomatic relationship of the Spirit to the Son is not proto, so it's not first, but rather the dioporthmutes. And again, I'll say conveyor from now on, just if there's any native Greek speakers out there, just so they can stop having a heart attack right now. So the conveyor, tu hagiu thumatos, so the of the Holy Spirit, the conveyor of the Holy Spirit. So there's a sort of idea of immediate procession, which is going on here with the idiomatic term, which is given to the Son. And actually this term of conveyor, it doesn't actually have any antecedent Greek fathers who use it. And it kind of doesn't get accepted in as a linguistic term later. So it's sort of an interesting, unique word to Leontius that he's using to express what's going on in the tradition previous to him. So it's clearly conveying that idea of that by which St. Gregory of Nyssa will often describe the relationship between the Son and the Spirit, which if you want, you can go and look at the debate with David Erhan in the opening in the rebuttal I bring up these texts. But the that by which given by St. Gregory of Nyssa, and then also the by the word, which is given by St. Maximus. This sort of language of the intermediary, which also is given by St. Maximus. There's this language of mediation, which is given by the Greek fathers. And clearly the ferryman or conveyor is conveying, no pun intended, this same idea. And then also we can see this from the protos. Okay, so continuing. And then the second one I brought up was Anastasius, the first of Antioch. Patriarch of Antioch in the 6th century, friends with Pope St. Gregory the Great. He was a defender of Chalcedonianism. He's quoted at the Second Nicene Council. And interestingly, he was martyred by Jews via disembowelment. So there's your very interesting fellow, a very interesting end. But he describes, interestingly, as we get most prominently in St. Cyril, so this has a very strong Cyrillian bent to him, although both of these fathers, very interestingly, are have experience, a lot of experience. Actually, Leontius grew up with the Nestorians and received his first formation in the monastic life from the Nestorians. I think he was a like disciple of one of the big Nestorians. I can't remember. Him, and then also obviously Anastasius of Antioch is going to have experience with the Nestorians. So very interesting that the that these two with the connections to Nestorianism are going to be very much strong witnesses of the procession of the Holy Spirit from the Son. So he's describing this substantial or natural relation. This is very much in line with what Cyril frequently says throughout his works. He says, for the relationship is natural, and that which has a certain way of relation brings in the other things. So there's a correlative, there's a correlative property to relations, towards which it has a natural relationship. Therefore, the Father brings in the Son, for if there was no Son, he would certainly not be Father. For who would be Father if the Son were not present? So because there's this natural relationship between the Father and the Son, there's Father, therefore there's Son. And again, how would there be a Son without a Father? Just as the one, so the other. But the Son, being Word, shows forth the Spirit with himself. So this same sort of correlative natural relationship between the Father and the Son is brought between the Son and the Spirit. Just as the one, so the other. But the Son brings the Word, showing forth the Spirit with himself. For there is no Word without Spirit, neither is there thought without Word. But we speak of the Father of the Word as thought. Thought in which there is the Word, and with which there is the Holy Spirit, the Spirit of the mouth of God, for the Son is the mouth of the Father. Therefore, the number of the Trinity is necessarily taken in the divine nature to demonstrate the persons distinguished from each other by their own characteristics. This number also shows their substantial relation to each other, co-eternal with the substance. So notice, when this is being explained there in the last sentence, it's being explained as their proper characteristics, which are being shown forth, their natural relationship, which is being shown. It's very Cyrillian in nature, absolutely. And then there is these last two that I wanted to bring up. Again, this wasn't that much. This was actually just a lot of researching in Mignet to track these down. So this language of existing from is brought up in the first quote. So he says, and the Holy Spirit is revealed together with the Father and the Son as with thought and word. Notice this language of thought and word is always being brought up. Indeed, the Lord, showing that it exists from himself, there you go. That was the emphasis that needed to be put on, exists from himself, breathed on the disciples and said, receive the Holy Spirit, which they themselves, praying through the laying on of their own hands, provided to those who believe. So notice, economy is revealing theology. That's what Anastasius here is revealing right here, no pun intended, in his quote. He's saying that the breathing of the Spirit on the disciples was showing something. It was revealing something. The economy, the temporal missions are revealing the intertrinitarian relations. So by breathing on the disciples, this is actually something that you see in Athanasius as well, by breathing on the disciples, the Son is showing that the Spirit exists from himself. Notice, exists from himself. Can't get much clearer than this. This is, to my knowledge, also St. Cyril, if I'm remembering correctly, his exegesis of this passage. Yes, it is his exegesis of the passage, definitely. I remember now for sure. And then continuing, he also grounds consubstantiality on these natural relations as well. So it's not consubstantiality itself, which is actually a mistake that people have with the interpretation of Maximus. They're saying that the proine of the Spirit from the Son shows forth their consubstantiality. It doesn't mean that it's just identical with their consubstantiality. It means that it's something which grounds their consubstantiality. So it obviously is not itself consubstantiality. Anyways, says the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father and receives all from the Son, who has all that belong. And this proceeds from the Father and receives from the Son. That was also a common phrase amongst the Greek fathers. St. Epiphanius famously used this all the time. The Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father and receives all from the Son, who has all that belongs to the Father, to demonstrate and manifest that there is one substance of both the receiver and the one from whom it is received, and the one from whom it naturally proceeds. for it did not proceed from a different nature, nor did it receive anything from the non-consubstantial. Since it is consubstantial with both the one from whom it proceeds, the other from whom it receives, they are clearly consubstantial with each other. So notice this reception isn't somehow described as being of something else than the procession is of. The reception of the procession is of the same thing. What is that? Substance, obviously, because it's grounding their consubstantiality. Okay, I'm going to check really quick the how many times can the anti-filioque position get debunked? Let me think. I could probably, if I had to guess, if I did one video every single week, maybe 40 to 45 more videos that I could do just on the filioque. Yeah, a lot of times. Okay, so that's all that I have. Thank you, everybody. I appreciate all of you. Remember, as I said in the beginning, definitely consider becoming a patron. And as always, God bless.